On this week's 51%, hear about storytelling and its effect on women.
It is a methodology that works on the impact of sexism and patriarchy in our culture, both when we work with women and when we work with men.
Learn how social workers are helping to prevent premature births and brush up on a brief history about women and voting. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true.
Storytelling is something we do every day, but without formality or even thinking about it. So how about exploring it as a way to empower women and clear space for impactful leadership? Though the TMI Project is not just for women, the nonprofit is offering a version of its storytelling workshop through the Omega Women's Leadership Center at the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in Rhinebeck, New York, at the end of August. I spoke with Executive Director Eva Tenuto about her TMI project.
TMI project is, it stands for what people think it stands for, too much information. We get people to tell the too much information parts of their stories, the parts that they usually leave out because they're too ashamed or embarrassed to share them. And after we set up a really safe space in our workshop and help people find the story that they feel they really need to tell through a series of very specific writing prompts and free writing exercises. We then help edit their stories and help them craft them into monologues specifically for stage performance. And they end up sharing the stories with audiences of hundreds sometimes that they previously thought they might not be able to share with just one person. And what we find is that when people are brave enough to share those stories and they tell them from the most honest point of view, they're met with a few different things. One of the things that happens is that they often are very afraid that they're going to be judged for whatever experience they went through. And what they find is that people will come up to them after the show and say, you know, I heard my story and your story. I've never heard anyone share it before. I was so inspired. It really touched me. We find that there's a contagious kind of truth-telling effect that happens through the communities that see the shows and have heard repeatedly that people end up telling each other stories on the way home or staying up for hours after the shows are over and sharing things that they were afraid to speak about. And then the other thing that happens for the participants is that all of this room that that story took up in their brain and in their thought process is freed up for them to be able to do other things, and they experience tremendous relief. So after we had experienced in the first couple of years that this kind of transformational impact was happening very consistently, we felt like we needed to start a community outreach initiative. And so we started working with a lot of different populations that really don't often have a chance to tell their stories or be heard. So we've now to date worked with incarcerated teen boys and women who've survived domestic violence situations. And we do an ongoing workshop with the Mental Health Association of Ulster County and work with a lot of adults who have mental illnesses that they're living with. We've also worked with many teens in the LGBTQ community and do an ongoing workshop at PTAC High School in Kingston. And then we started doing work around leadership, women in leadership. And we were hired by an organization called Gender at Work, who flew in gender activists from all over the world, from Pakistan and South Africa and India and lots of different countries. And we met in New York City and did a workshop around the ways that patriarchy is still impacting those of us who are working in the gender activist community and revealing those stories through the workshop process. And those women ended up telling their stories at the UN for the Commission for the Status of Women in 2015.
Okay, once the story is shared, what happens with the storyteller longer term? Are you seeing results where they're able to tackle things they couldn't before or find solutions to problems?
Absolutely. And in fact, we're just in the very beginning stages of putting together a podcast where we can, you know, feature the stories that they've told, but also interview the storytellers who've had a couple years now since they told their story so that people can hear the other story, which is, what did it feel like before you told your story? And then what happened in your life after? Because those are the stories that people don't get to see just from coming to the shows. There are quite a few that I could cite, but there's one woman who comes to mind who just took the workshop about a year ago. And she took the workshop through the Mental Health Association program in Ulster County. And she had been, she's a young woman in her 20s. She had a psychotic break and had been hospitalized 5 different times. She came to us through the ACT program, which is a program that is like a last resort. It's when lots of other programs have not worked yet. And so she ended up in the workshop. And when she came in, she was very, very shy and still participated, but really was very reserved. But she kept showing up. She kept sharing her writing. She kept telling her story. And then when we edited her work for her and brought the piece back in, and she read it that first time in the classroom setting, when she was done, it was as if like an internal light got turned on. And she said, oh my God, this is how I've always wanted to be able to tell my story. Like, you got it exactly. You nailed it. And the next day was our performance. So she told her story in front of an audience. And I had not seen something that drastic in such a short period of time in a while. She just really looked like a completely different person. And so I offered her to come with us the following day to read her story for a group of high school students. And I let her know, like, these are, high school students can be an unkind audience. Like, they can be a tough crowd. I want you to make sure that you're okay with that. And she said, no, I really want to. I want to share my story with young people. And she shared her story at the high school. She inspired some of those kids who are struggling with mental health issues to sign up for our workshop and who've been with us for the last year. She's gone on to do a public story slam with us where she competed in a story slam about, it was the pet themed story slam, and she talked about her service dog. She's then gone on with us to, she just traveled to Buffalo with us and performed for 200 people when we got hired by AmeriCorps. And now she's started a blog about mental health issues. She's been published on MTV.com. She's receiving an award for young people through the YWCA this year. So she's gone on to really thrive and open up and experience her life in a way that she really credits to the experience of being able to tell the story in the way that she wanted to and inspire others. I think that's been a really important part for her, is that it's now this experience that she went through is serving her to do something good in the world.
Speak to the value, please, if you will, of storytelling in an age when people are glued to screens. Because your storytelling is happening in person. I know there's the podcast on the way that you mentioned, but there's this personal connection and connecting with a live audience. What's the value of this, as I said, in this day when people are glued to screens?
I think it's one of the reasons why live storytelling has taken on such popularity recently in the recent years, is because I think we all crave a level of in-person intimacy that we used to take for granted and that is becoming more and more rare. I think, you know, it's interesting. We're exploring all of these ways that we can get these wonderful stories out to a larger audience. And yet I'm a theater geek at heart and I love the in-person on stage. There is the person right in front of you telling you in the audience their personal story. And there's something about it that feels so powerful to be sitting in that room when something that profound is happening. I know that a lot of the audience members say that they just feel so honored to have been there and to be in the presence of such powerful truth telling. And I think the in-person portion of it is something that we never want to lose, regardless of whether or not we do a podcast or we start streaming videos or doing whatever, you know, technology is offering to us at this point. I think the live aspect is incredibly important because we don't often sit face to face, even across a table from one another, and tell each other what has happened that day or in our lives. And it's also interesting in a time where there is so much negative oversharing to be oversharing in a way that is hopefully much more positive.
What do you mean we're oversharing?
Well, I think that when people are on screens, they will often, they'll say things to each other or share things that they wouldn't necessarily share if they were in front of someone. So I think that social media has brought a different kind of TMI into the world, where we're more easily critical of one another, where we're putting things out to a large audience that we wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable telling that group of people if they were standing in front of us. And I think that this is a way that takes the idea of sharing things that are personal, but doing it in a way that is very intentional and provides connection.
What do you see difference-wise, even though it may be a gross generalization, in storytelling between men and women?
I think one of the things that I value in the work that we're doing is that it is a methodology that works on the impact of sexism and patriarchy in our culture, both when we work with women and when we work with men. And these will be gross generalizations, but just to provide like an overview, when we work with men, one of the things that I love about the work is that there are not that many spaces where men are not just given permission to talk about things that they've been through and share their emotional stories, but also given some instruction on how. You know, I think that there are a lot of men who might crave being able to tell their story and be in a space where they can be heard, but just the inexperience of speaking in that way prevents them from knowing what to say and when to say it and who to say it to. I think that there's something that we're starting to see and some work that we're doing intentionally to help shift the cultural expectations around masculinity by providing space where men can tell the stories that they've not been allowed to share. And then for women, I think that there are ways that we have not tapped into owning our stories, our full power in telling our stories and taking up space and being on stage and having the spotlight on our experience, on not focusing on someone else, being able to talk about what we've been through, what we've survived, what we've lived through in a really honest and candid way, and help it relieve anything that might be holding us back from our full potential, whatever that may be. And so in this context of women in leadership, I think that there are tremendous benefits to being able to share personal stories and have them get out of the way so you can keep moving forward. I feel like even for myself, the work that I've done in the organization, and we take the workshop when we teach it, so I'm telling personal stories all the time. It's always peeling the onion and taking off the next layer of things that might be holding me back and places that I might be afraid to go and stepping into them boldly anyway. So I love how it can come at this issue from both angles and hope that that's what we experience when we're at Omega, that we can have a lot of women really feeling like they're stepping into something that feels really powerful and that they're shedding something that might have been holding them back, so that when they finish the workshop and they go home, they will not just have a story in their hands, but they'll have potential to be living things out in a different way.
It sounds like an opportunity to become unstuck, more empowered, and over a longer period of time.
You know, one of the things that I love about the work that we do is that it really is appropriate for anyone. Anyone who's willing and has a desire to share a story that maybe they're afraid to share. But I think that regardless of what background you come from, what culture you're a part of, we all get messages in some form or another that say, don't air out your dirty laundry. What happens in the family stays in the family. You know, we're not supposed to show these certain emotions. We're not supposed to say that this certain thing happened. So I think that we all have certain stories that are holding us back in some way. Or even if we feel like we're thriving in our lives and want to just kind of like explore an area that we haven't shined a light on, I really think that it can be a moving experience for anyone if they're willing and interested in doing the work. One of the things that I think gets missed when I talk about the work sometimes is that it can all sound so serious and there's actually a lot of laughter and a lot of comedic pieces that come out of the workshop.
Eva, how did you come to start TMI?
I grew up keeping secrets in my family. When I was 11, I found out that my mom had a son that she gave up for adoption, and I discovered it by listening in on a phone call and didn't tell my sisters that I knew that for years. So I was the only kid in the family who knew that there was a child missing. It wasn't so much the information that I had, but it was that I did not share it that ended up causing me so many problems. And I ended up having pretty severe alcoholism for years and got sober about 11 years ago. And I had also done theater my whole life. So when I went into recovery, the thing that I loved the most was hearing stories. I loved the part of hearing people tell their true stories. And I ended up getting a gig directing the vagina monologues and did it 2 years in a row for a local women's organization after I got sober. And we raised a lot of money for this local women's organization. So the third year they asked me if I would do it again. And what I said to them was, I would love if I could take this group of women that I've been working with and have them tell their own true stories this year, because I know that, you know, three of the women who are in the cast have one woman shows that have never been produced, and another woman's been working on a memoir, and another one has short stories. And I know we have stories in us that could be really turned into a great performance. And so they allowed us to try it that year. And that was how TMI Project was born. I do think that there's been a real influence, and I've been inspired by the recovery model, although it was not intentional at all, but that there is so much power in hearing how someone else has gone through something that you've been through and hearing it told in the rawest fashion and then feeling inspired that you can do the same thing that they have, that they've been as low as you've been and that they are now thriving and that's possible for you too. That was 6 years ago. And since then, it wasn't even something that I thought was going to turn into a full nonprofit organization and be years in the making. But it has just kept moving and moving and growing and growing, and I just keep following along.
That was Eva Tenuto, executive director of the TMI Project, based in New York. To learn more, visit tmiproject.org. Premature birth can lead to long-term health and developmental problems and is one of the main reasons parents lose their babies. To prevent this, OBGYNs have tools to monitor fetal health, like ultrasounds and amniocentesis. But how do you address risk factors that aren't so easily observed in the doctor's office, like chronic unemployment, a stressful home life, or depression? From Missouri, Side Effects Public Media's Bram Sable-Smith reports.
In 30 years as an obstetrics nurse, Mary Beth Hollinshead says she's pretty much seen it all. High-risk deliveries, low-risk ones, inpatient, outpatient. But she says,
there's always been that time where you're trying to think, what are we missing with this patient? We've done everything medically, but yet we're still getting a preterm delivery.
For the past 2 years, she's been trying to answer that question for Signature Medical Group here in Missouri. They're one of 27 organizations around the country to receive a federal grant to try a program called Strong Start. The idea is to help expectant mothers on Medicaid connect with services to manage the stresses in their lives. They do that by putting social workers into the OB's office. Well, maybe not always in the office.
In 800 feet, continue onto North Skanker Parkway.
Megan Bragers is one of those social workers. She's driving up to Ferguson, Missouri to meet an expectant mother named Marie Anderson, who's 33 weeks pregnant.
I had called her about a month ago and come to find that she's been in a car accident, her car's been totaled, she's having back issues, she's having increased depressive symptoms, that things have gotten pretty difficult.
Difficult, or as Anderson says,
whew, a tornado. That's the only thing to describe it, a tornado.
After her car accident, she started having back issues, and her baby, a daughter she's already named Dallas, is painfully resting on her sciatic nerve. She tells Bragers she's had to have early contractions stopped twice since they last met, and her 3-year-old son, Aiden, couldn't go with her to the hospital, which he didn't like at all.
He got nervous.
You got nervous when mommy was not feeling well? You thought she was going to be here.
Mad.
You were mad.
You wanted to go?
Yeah.
You got to come after Dallas come out.
Aiden was born by emergency C-section, one of several factors making Anderson's pregnancy high risk. Another is depression, which is already more common for low-income women during pregnancy. And Anderson's been struggling with it since her brother's sudden death in a car crash 5 months ago.
I think I'm just mainly sad because I lost my brother.
Yeah.
I can be laying in my bed and I see something that we did or we said, and it just makes me cry.
Yeah.
Preventing preterm births has to start with women like Marie Anderson. More premature births happen in this little zip code where she lives than anywhere else in the St. Louis area, which itself accounts for a full quarter of all the premature births in the entire state. Throughout Anderson's pregnancy, Breggers has helped her get enrolled in Medicaid and set up with a mental health counselor and into physical therapy and home visits from a nurse. And at the end of their hour-long visit today, Anderson says she thinks she can get close to full term.
I think I can hold her until 36 weeks. I really do. It's just a mind thing.
This kind of case management has helped the Strong Start program in St. Louis lower the preterm birth rate by 23% for the 2,000 women they've seen. But the challenge now for people like Mary Beth Hollinshead who run these Strong Start programs is figuring out how to fund them when the grant money goes away.
There needs to be a way to bill for case management and enhanced prenatal care.
That means convincing insurers that this model is worth paying for, and fast. The last pregnancy covered by the grant in Missouri is due in August. Bram Sablesmith, SideFX Public Media.
This story was produced by SideFX Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. Hillary Clinton made history when she became the first woman to accept the nomination for president from a major political party. As the Innovation Trail's Beth Adams reports, the historic moment came nearly 96 years after women won the right to vote.
Some say because Hillary Clinton has been a political figure for decades, it's not really that big of a deal that her name will appear at the top of the Democratic ticket in November. But Deborah Hughes, head of the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum, couldn't disagree more.
It's a huge deal. It's something we've been waiting for almost 100 years.
Actually, 96 years this August since the 19th Amendment was ratified, ending the suffrage movement that Anthony led and giving women the right to vote. Hughes says Anthony's fellow suffragist, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, predicted it would be 100 years before some of the changes the early leaders of the women's rights movement wanted to see would come to fruition. There are still issues today, though, that were important in the early 20th century, which Hughes says still need our attention today.
In this country, we have more women and children trapped in poverty than we ever have. What does that mean, and how do we become a nation where we don't have such huge disparities of wealth and disparities of opportunity?
Hughes says young women may not think a female president would be significant, and she says that's a good thing. It means a generation of women have come of age without facing gender barriers to their dreams. In Rochester, I'm Beth Adams.
Reporting by the Innovation Trail is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For more, visit innovationtrail.org. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker signed a pay equity bill August 1st, and it was passed unanimously by both legislative branches. The legislation aims to ensure equal pay for comparable work for Massachusetts workers and equal opportunities to earn competitive salaries in the workplace. It's called an Act to Establish Pay Equity and goes into effect July 1, 2018 for Commonwealth employers and employees. 51%'s Jim Lavoulis has more.
The bill's supporters say Massachusetts is the first state to adopt a provision defining what comparable work is. Democratic Senator Pat Jalin sponsored the legislation.
It says that when you're hiring someone, you can't ask about their previous salary history, which keeps people. That is a practice which locks women into lower salaries for their whole career.
Supporters say women are currently paid on average about 82% of what their male counterparts make for comparable work in Massachusetts. Jalin says based on input from the business community, there is language outlining bona fide reasons for discrepancy in pay that are not discriminatory.
That was 51%'s Jim Lavoulis. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1412.